everyone, and welcome back to Yellow Bee Pod. My name is Natalie. I'm a British-born Chinese woman based in London, and in this podcast we talk all about culture, identity, and other experiences that relate to East and Southeast Asian diaspora. People from East and Southeast Asian descent who don't necessarily live in the homeland now. Seems like a lot of you really liked the dating apps conversation in my previous episode, episode 6. It was a really, really fun topic to start a conversation on. In the last episode, I said that a lot of guys have similar pictures on their dating profile. So a lot of guys might have the same pictures of them hiking or doing a bungee jump or at a wedding. One of our listeners got in touch to say that a lot of women have the same thing on their profile. Like, it might say something like, I'm looking for someone with good communication skills. And he says, don't most girls want that? It doesn't seem unique. A lot of girls say stuff like, I like falling asleep with my partner holding my hand. Why put that on a profile? Apparently he says, oh yeah, there's one about otters that lots have. I've seen so many with that. Quote, I love that otters hold hands. And he says, I'll hold hands, but is that really worth putting on your profile? That's true. I guess when you're swiping a lot, you do see a lot of the same stuff. And people might think that they're being kind of quirky or cute or unique, but we're really not. We've all got the same rubbish on our dating app profiles. Another listener said, also, I know your podcast is East and Southeast Asian, but I wrote to Hinge and complained that they didn't have Sikh as an option in the religion section. I don't know if they amended it yet, but I got an email saying that they're sorry, and then they upgraded me to a premium account, lol. That's so funny, and it's really weird that they wouldn't have Sikh as an option. I mean, it's not like it's some niche religion, it's one of the biggest religions in the world. And you know, someone from East and Southeast Asia can be Sikh too. This is what Hinge said. We're currently working to add Sikh as a religion option, as it would be, in fact, very important for this community to be represented. As the fifth largest religion in the world, there should be representation on the Hinge platform for Sikhs. and then she said, she got Hinge Premium out of it. So I guess it's good to complain, it's good to write in, and this is the representation that we need and deserve on dating apps. I also talked to this episode's guest a bit about dating apps, so stick around for that. And thanks to everyone who got in touch to say that they liked the previous episode. Well, I've been watching quite a lot of Netflix, actually. Does anyone watch Dynasty? It's like a remake of the old 80s, I think, TV show. They just released a whole season on Netflix. I would actually prefer it if they released episodes like week by week, like the good old days, because then you can talk to people about it. And it's quite rare for me to finish a whole season of a drama TV show. So I really, really want to talk to someone about Dynasty, but I don't actually know who. Does anyone else watch it? I also re-watched a Netflix stand-up special by Hasan Minhaj. So he has a TV show called The Patriot Act on Netflix, which is so, so good. That's back for another season as well. But yeah, I love that show, and I really wish that they had like a UK version of it, because a lot of the topics that he talks about is very American focused. So if anyone out there wants to be the UK version of Hasan Minhaj, I will fully, fully support that show. Definitely would like to see something like that. But yeah, he also has a Netflix special, which I rewatched, and oh my God, I forgot how good it is. So he's talking about like immigrant parents and the relationship with his sister when his sister immigrated from India. He talks about inter-religion dating, and a big part of his story is, okay, spoiler alert, is getting rejected by his prom date's white family. It's really, really funny, but also really like relatable and interesting, even though I'm not from like a Muslim or Indian background. But yeah, I don't know why I didn't remember it being that funny, but yeah, definitely worth a watch and a rewatch. It's called Homecoming King. Something else definitely worth checking out, something from Omnibus Theatre called We Are Not Virus, but the word R is the letter R. I'll put the hashtag and the link in the description below. Actually, wait, let me get the press release up so I can get this information right. So the tagline is, you see a contagion, you make an equation, you fear an invasion when it's your evasion. Wait, I had to reread that a few times, but I think you can figure out what it means. I know it's a bit insincere to read it right from the press release, but here we go. A collective of leading actors, writers, directors, and creative of East and Southeast Asian heritage from the UK's performing arts industry are joining forces next month. That's June. Oh my God, we're nearly in June. June starts next week. Oh my God. It's also my birthday this week, which has really crept up on me. So I'm releasing this episode on Saturday. My birthday's on Sunday, the last day of May. I'm going to have to celebrate my birthday another time, I think. Anyway, yes, I haven't explained this very well. Basically, it's an online arts event called We Are Not Virus. It's a response to the increase of hate crime towards East and Southeast Asian people related to COVID-19. And it's supported by the Arts Council Emergency Fund, which is so great to hear that they're supporting like work like this at this time, because we really need arts at this time and arts really need support. So it's a free online event on the 13th and 14th of June. The first batch of tickets have actually sold out, but if you're listening to this now, click on the link in the show notes because they're going to release a second batch of tickets. I'm not sure exactly when, but they said soon, so it might be out right now. Go and click in the show notes. I'm really excited to see what this will be about. It's going to be a mix of like lots of different like creatives and art forms, and it's all happening on Zoom. Isn't that amazing? Like everything's happening on Zoom these days. Do you remember in my previous episode about COVID-19 related racism, I said that someone in US politics used a phrase Kung Flu, which was just completely inappropriate and really offensive. So that stupid pun has resurfaced again in the last week because I'm not going to name them, they're a British dessert company. As part of their marketing, they use that term Kung Flu almost like a punny joke. But obviously like everyone was commenting saying this is offensive, blah, blah, blah. And they took it down really quick. But in this day and age, everything gets screenshot and they had to sort of make an apology, rightly so. Actually, their apology was really shit. You can tell if someone's really sorry by the way that they apologize, and I don't really think that they were sorry at all. I just want to raise that because it happens like close to home. This is a British organization and they were using these terms with absolutely no sensitivity. Either they didn't know it was offensive, which is a problem in itself, or they knew it was offensive and didn't care. But yeah, their apology was pretty rubbish. The founder of the company said, "We have a lot of social media posts that are a play on words, but now can understand it could be taken the wrong way, and for that I apologize." So they didn't really apologize for saying it. They said that they apologized that it could have been taken the wrong way, you know? And they said, "We have received threats of violence, abuse, and have had bad reviews written by the members of the Chinese community. I hope that my apology will put an end to them and that any bad reviews will be removed." He literally doesn't care about who he offended. He only cares about, like, his company not doing well now that the Chinese community is complaining. And a lot of people are talking about racism this week, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but I just want to say a quick thing. Actually, over this last week, there's just been a lot going on, and since the start of lockdown, I've been pretty good about limiting the amount of news that I see on TV and on social media, just for my own well-being. It's quite intense to be seeing like negative numbers about the mortality rate of coronavirus all the time. But over the last week, the news and everything has been quite intense. Should I be thinking about SpaceX or whatever the UK government is announcing? And should I be caring about what the Prime Minister's senior advisor was doing over Easter weekend? Like, it's a lot. But of course, the biggest thing was about police brutality in the US, and I really don't want to oversimplify it, and a lot of people have been commenting and saying their piece. And something worth raising is that one of the policemen who was standing watch while a black man died in America, George Floyd. Yeah, so one of the policemen who was just like standing there is like visibly East or Southeast Asian, and I guess this is a reminder, not that we need it, of sort of anti-blackness within Asian communities all around the world. And I think it's really easy for us to say that policemen are racist, or wait, the hashtag that was trending was like, all cops are bastards, which say like, oh, there's so much racism in America or whatever. But we really need to check ourselves first. Like, we know that there is anti-blackness in Asian communities, and it's our responsibility to do something about that. But like, firstly, we need to check ourselves. I'm not 100% sure how I feel about trial by public opinion. Like, there's one policeman who is in the center of all this. He's the one who actually had his knee like on George Floyd's neck. A lot of people have been sharing photos of his wife, Kelly Chauvin, who I don't know if this is relevant, but she's of Asian descent. She's Hmong. They were saying stuff like, here's her social media, she should get fired. And I don't know how I feel about that. Because, I mean, she doesn't work in the police force, but her husband does. And yeah, it's just sort of like this sort of trial by public opinion, and the fact that her social media is being, I can't even imagine the sort of harassment that she's getting now. The point that I wanted to make is that we can all look to ourselves. This is something that we can all do. So taking a step to sort out racism in our own communities, our families even, like really, really close to home. We've all had this stark reminder that it really exists. It's always been there. I don't want to rush into the conversation because I want to do it right, but that's where I'm at now. Ultimately, it's the case that we need to keep talking about it. We can't just sweep things under a rug, and we can, yeah, there's a lot that we can do. And lots of resources out there if you want to look at how you can support like Black Lives Matter movements. Yeah, so we can all do better, and we should be demanding that from people in our own families and communities. If you don't know how, let's talk about it. Find me on Twitter, Instagram at yellowbpod, or you can email me anonymously as well. yellowbpod@gmail.com. I think we need to be open about what we can do better, because that's the only way that the situation's ever going to change. Another thing that has been taking up a lot of my brain space over this last week has been some violence against Chinese people in Zambia. And again, really oversimplifying the whole history and situation, there's a huge amount of Chinese investment and Chinese like businesses in lots of African countries, including in Zambia. And I don't fully have an idea of what's going on, but it seems like there's been building tensions, and it's definitely been playing on my mind since I heard this news. And I also care about it for selfish reasons, because I've spent some time in Zambia in the past, and of course I am Chinese. I've got flights booked to go visit Zambia in September of this year. And even though it's a few months away, obviously, I don't know what the COVID situation is going to be like then. It may be the case that that trip won't happen. It's a trip that's been a long time coming. I spent some time in the capital of Zambia, in Lusaka, back in 2017, a couple months I was there. And since I've left, basically, we've been really, really excited to go back and visit, and I hope my holiday can still happen. Obviously, it's awful that this stuff is happening, but I'm going to be honest, I care for selfish reasons. I'm not super, super clear of what's going on, because whether you read the news from like Chinese or British or Zambian news sources, it could be like a different bias. So it's hard to get a real good picture of what's actually happening. But this is something that I'm conscious of, so something that has been playing on my mind a lot. Just want to get a better idea of what's happening. Super excited to have Evelyn Mock. She is a comedian who I heard of through the Rice to Meet You podcast. And we do talk about some fruity adult topics in the second half of our conversation. So this is your warning. If it isn't for you, that's fine. If it is for you, but you have children or colleagues around, maybe, you know, listen with some headphones. We do use some adult language. I really hope you enjoy this episode. Here we are, back for another episode. I'm so delighted to be joined by stand-up comedian, writer, fellow podcaster, Evelyn Mock.
Hi, Natalie.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well. I'm really excited to chat to you today, as I'm a big fan of the podcast that you are on called Rice to Meet You.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I'm co-hosting Rice to Meet You podcast with my friend and comedian Nigel Ng from Malaysia. And so, yeah, that's really fun. We talk about Asian culture in hopefully a kind of funny, light way, and just kind of, I guess, very much nostalgic way as well, because we're both sort of, he moved from Malaysia to the UK, and I grew up in the West, so all of these kind of Asian things are very, remind me of growing up as a kid. So it's kind of nostalgic to have a podcast to talk about all of the things that you experienced as a kid and thought was weird, but actually is quite common and experienced among like so many other people.
Yeah, I find it super relatable. It's really fun. And it's also very validating to know that I'm not crazy by having these experiences and these thoughts, because other people have them too. And it's a really, really funny podcast. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's really exciting that you've started your own podcast about like Asian culture and Asian things.
Yeah, definitely. I just know that There are a lot of people that I already knew within my network that weren't getting a platform, and a lot of podcasts that I listened to were Asian but Asian American.
Oh yeah.
And I felt like, why is the community like in the UK not so strong? Because we do have a big British Chinese community here as well as other countries, and that's what ultimately spurred me to start it, because I felt a bit envious of the communities that they had in like West Coast America, where there's loads of Asian people apparently.
Yeah, they have such a great community over there. Me too. When I grew up, it was like, if there was any like Asian content that I consumed, like kind of Western based Asian content, it was Asian American. So it was a lot of like, I felt such a big affinity with the Asian American community. But it's different from like the UK experience and from like the Swedish experience growing up as an Asian over here. But that was the only thing that was out there.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I still feel that way as well. And then I start calling bubble tea boba.
That's I don't know.
But we do have our own experiences here.
Yeah.
So you grew up in Sweden. What was that like?
It was good. I mean, like being like a Swedish citizen is, it's not a lot to complain about because it's such a great societal structure. Like you're taken care of. The government really looks out for you. But when it comes to being not white, that's a bit worse because there is kind of a structural, hierarchical, kind of racist system here. But the thing is, Swedes don't necessarily acknowledge it, which makes it difficult. And if it's not acknowledged, it's really difficult to affect change, which is why I've enjoyed living in the UK and also just looking at where the conversation is in America. People are actually having a conversation and actually talking about it and actually acknowledging it, that there is a problem. That way, your feelings are acknowledged to a certain extent if you live over there. Whereas here, you kind of feel crazy or you feel, you don't want to be the buzzkill, basically, if you bring anything like this up.
I can imagine. I have been in sort of situations like that within the UK as well, where I feel like I can't call something out if I find something, or something is definitely racist, but I still feel like I can't call it out because they will either think that I'm the one who's making things political, they obviously use that word political, or they just think that it's actually not racist at all. And they might say, oh, it's just a joke, or don't take it so personally, or you can say the same back to me, but it's not the same because of the ethnicity.
Exactly.
I have to admit, I know very, very little about Sweden, but in my head, it's all like very tall, blonde people. Is that a stereotype or is that real?
That's pretty real. I mean, that's pretty real. Yeah. It's, I mean, Swedish people are gorgeous. There's nothing to complain about there. They're like, they're kind of Hitler's wet dream.
Oh my God.
That's what he imagined. I'm sorry if it, this is, so sorry. This is the tone that I have on my own podcast, but I'm sorry if this is too much for your podcast.
No, not at all. I want people to be comfortable and to be real because we all have different experiences. And just because I don't have that experience or I might disagree with something, it's not for me to define like what is a Asian experience, you know?
Yeah, that's true. It's and the more that I've started doing the podcast, the more I realize that too. Because just looking at my own experience and Nigel's experience, because he was born and raised in Malaysia and grew up there, and then he came here as an adult, but I was born and raised in Sweden and grew up here. It's just the Asian experience is so nuanced. And I think that when you look at media or something like that, it's not portrayed that way. There's no room for nuance in the media landscape, or what's it called, in like film and television.
Mm-hmm.
When we see like an Asian character, it's always the same kind of slight stereotype. Like, you know, in the 50s, it was Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. And now it's progressed, but it's still like, oh, it's the immigrant kid experience, which is like, oh, yeah, the tiger mom and the pressures of doing well in school. And you have to like become like an engineer or a doctor. And then
that's
it's like,
my background. I'm an engineer.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, that's your background. That's so funny. Yeah. Well, my background is like, my parents weren't that harsh. Like, they were like, yeah, okay, as long as you can make money and sustain yourself financially. But yeah, so that's really funny because you had that the background of the kind of ambition.
But I do recognise it is a stereotype, it's a trope. Stereotypes do usually come from some form of truth, yeah. And there are lots of people who have that experience. But I do find that I play into it as well, because I know that that's what's going to make me fit in, and that's a conversation piece for, you know, other Asian people. Like, it's like you can just go up to any sort of Chinese person and say, are your parents disappointed in you? Or did they used to beat you as a kid? Or what did they beat you with? Like, and that's just like seen as such like a conversation starter. And I sometimes feel like, oh, I shouldn't be playing into this so much. Because my mum, I wouldn't say she was a tiger mum, but she did sort of push us to do maths, but I wouldn't say in a tiger mum way. But I do feel like I step into that trope a little bit.
But at the same time, it's like, it depends on who the receiver is. Because if you talk to somebody who shared that experience with you, like another Chinese kid, because we know the nuance, we know the breadth of all the experiences, we know that this is not just the one way. So it's more like we're talking about our culture together and making fun of it. But if you talk to somebody who's not from our culture and who maybe has like an idea of how it is, then that's the sole kind of vision or the sole picture they have of our culture. And in that case, there is a risk that it's like, oh, am I playing into stereotypes now? But it's so much about like who is the receiver of what you're speaking about. And that's something that I've kind of noticed in comedy as well, because if I do jokes on stage and I talk about being Asian, if I do it for an Asian audience, I'm talking about our culture and having fun with it. And everybody knows the references and stuff. But if I'm doing it for a predominantly white audience, then I have to sort of find a way to explain the context as well as the joke.
Do you ever find it difficult when you're doing stand-up comedy for a predominantly white audience that you don't want to play into those stereotypes or use the sort of caricature of an Asian person using those jokes, which they might find funny? It might be like an easy laugh, but it's not sort of true to your own values.
Absolutely. Especially when I started out, I was always really mindful and kind of almost afraid, I think, of doing jokes that would kind of perpetuate stereotypes. But then as the longer that I've been doing this, I've realized that this is like my experience and this is what I want to talk about. And so I should do it unapologetically. Of course, think about how it comes off, but not try to limit myself to what I can talk about out of fear from what other people will, you know, judge or project onto me.
Yeah.
And it's a tough realization to have. And it's also a tough road to get to that realization. Because I think growing up as in a diaspora, your identity has always been sort of invalidated in some way, because I'm not Swedish enough to be Swedish. I'm not Chinese enough to be Chinese. And so I'm sort of in this kind of middle ground, which a lot of people have spoken about this, but like a third culture kid. And so your identity sort of is invalidated from both ends. So you kind of end up not knowing fully or feeling fully comfortable, I guess, with who you are, unless you choose to assimilate to the Western culture or try to go hardcore into the Chinese culture. But then I never did get into Chinese culture that much, because I felt like I was made to feel ashamed of being Chinese because of how Chinese people were portrayed in media and stuff, especially in Sweden. It's like pretty bad still.
I did see that on my favorite source of Wikipedia, it said that a piece of research about xenophobia in Sweden, it says 70% of Swedes had a negative view of China, and you have both Swedish and Chinese background. I wanted to hear whether that was your experience of it or whether you had a very different experience from that.
No, it's pretty accurate.
Oh no, I'm sorry to hear that.
It's interesting because it's like here in Sweden, it's like, I think maybe it's similar to Britain in the regard of like, oh, it's the Chinese takeaway thing, you know? So they're like, oh, we will go and have like a Chinese takeaway and stuff. And then they'll make fun of the people working there because they can't pronounce, you know, certain words. It's almost like you look down upon the Chinese the Chinese people who work in restaurants and stuff. And then now with like kind of food revolution, all of these kind of young hipster people are demanding authentic Chinese food.
Yeah.
And then kind of chastising all of the takeaways that have been around, which, by the way, you know, were adapted that way because your parents didn't have like an exciting palate. So they wouldn't eat authentic Chinese food. So that's what had to happen in order to survive. So now they're kind of chastising the takeaway food and only wanting authentic food, and then opening their own kind of fusion places to cater to, you know, that demand, which is like a form of prejudice in itself, which I don't think people realize. In Sweden, it's really bad because kind of making fun of Chinese people, especially now that China is emerging as a superpower, isn't considered racism. And really recently, like last year, a Swedish TV show, which is like the equivalent of The MASH Report or like The Daily Show, they're trying to make it that equivalent. So the backstory is there were some Chinese tourists who were in Stockholm. It was a Chinese family, and they booked themselves into a hostel, but they had mistook the date. So they arrived a day earlier than their booking. And so the hostel couldn't accommodate them. Instead of, you know, going and finding another hotel, they just decided to sit in the hostel in the lounge area, sort of overnight, I guess. And they just sat there, and the hostel didn't like this. They were like, you can't just sit here if you don't have a room booking. But the tourists kind of decided to stay. And then the police got involved. They called the police, and the police came, and they removed them forcefully from the hostel. So it was pretty dramatic. And so they carried them out, and the Chinese tourists like were crying and saying that they were getting hurt and badly treated. And so this became like a sensational story. And the Chinese embassy got involved, demanded an apology from the Swedish police, which they didn't get. And so the Chinese tourism board started telling Chinese tourists to not go to Sweden because they'll get treated poorly. So this TV show then decided to make fun of the situation. So they decided to make a spoof tourism video. They say it's satire. I called it racist because in it, it wasn't a critique of the government. It was just blatant racism. So one of the things that was said in this video was, oh, if you see a Swedish person walking a dog, that doesn't mean that they're taking their lunch to work. That means that they're walking their pet. They were like, also, you can't poop in the streets in Sweden. And I was like, wow.
Okay.
And these are my friends, by the way. Like, I knew these people. These are comedians that I know. And they called me up and asked me if I could be the person who presented this tourism advert. And I was like, I didn't get the script or anything, but I just knew that it was a bad idea. Because these are white Swedish people who are doing satire. They're not going to have any sensitivity at all. All the people on the writing team, they're all white. They have no person of color in that thing. And also, what I found baffling was, I'm Swedish and Chinese. Surely, if you're going to write something about this, you should ask me.
You would think.
You should ask me. I could give you the cultural reasons for why it went down as it did. And I can, it was just a really big mess. And then they sent it out and it went viral in China. It angered the Chinese tourism board and it angered the Chinese embassy, and they demanded an apology, which they never got. And so it's been a bit tenuous ever since then.
And when did that occur?
Last year. So that happened last year, which is just mind-boggling to me that they basically got away with racism. China's pretty much, they've done a lot of like, they've invested a lot in Swedish companies, and they've also bought up like Swedish car brands. So I think that's sort of the background. Like, they're seeing China as this like superpower because they're coming in here and buying companies.
So they feel threatened, and then therefore they're going to make jokes about eating dogs.
Yeah, I don't know if they feel threatened, but they definitely feel like they're punching up.
Right, I see. Okay.
Something that I've been thinking about is like, the sort of like reasoning behind making fun of Chinese people is always like, oh, we're punching up because China's a superpower and also they're an autocracy and blah, 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 and communism and everything. They don't have any human rights. And it's like, yeah, but that's the Chinese government, not Chinese people. Chinese people don't like the Chinese government either, but you're not making fun of the government. You're making fun of Chinese people. And that's causing consequences that'll be suffered by people who look like me in real life. And so that's always the thing. And people never distinguish between the two, which is quite upsetting.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, because I wouldn't have heard about that situation probably if I hadn't heard it from you. It definitely is like a striking incident, but definitely not unique, unfortunately, because these sort of things happen in countries all over the world. And it must be particularly difficult for you as a Swedish Chinese person, but then also within your working world in comedy in Sweden, particularly if you knew those individuals. And we all should feel like we have a place where we can fit in our life, but also in our work. And it's not easy if there's people out there making jokes against people who look like you.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Yeah. And it was really disappointing because it was one of my good friends who worked on that too. So it was like, this is just really strange, and I can't really understand that you guys don't understand that this is bad. But I think that's the conversation on race in Sweden. It hasn't evolved at all because Swedish people don't necessarily want to confront themselves when it comes to their own prejudice. And that's kind of a sad place to be.
Yeah, it's difficult. And even though I'm not in the comedy circle and I'm only a fan, but even I know that comedy is a very sort of white man's world. And I think that's represented quite well in the movie Late Night. I don't know whether you've seen it.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So it's a movie based on the late night shows in America. And Mindy Kaling plays the main character who becomes the first person of color and the first woman in the writer's room for a late night show, which is hosted by Emma Thompson. And there's a great line in the movie, I don't want to misquote it, but it's effectively she's saying, I would rather be a diversity hire than a nepotism hire, because that's how people saw her, as a diversity hire. They didn't respect her as a writer or as a person who could contribute equally. And yeah, I thought that was such a great movie and a really great line that has stuck with me.
Yeah, that's really true. It was a really good way of looking at how the situation is really and nowadays in comedy, because I think it's changing and it's getting there, but I think that sadly is still how it kind of is.
Mm-hmm. Well, despite your challenges in the comedy scene, you've had some great successes as well. So you've had two Edinburgh shows.
Yeah.
One is called Bubble Butts and one is called, I don't really say either of these words out loud, so saying them together is extra strange, Hymen Maneuver.
yeah.
How fun.
Yeah.
What is it like performing in Edinburgh as part of the Fringe?
It's really fun. It's different. The first time I went, there was no place like it. It's kind of like if you're a creative, if you're a comedian, if you're like any, if you do any type of performance, there's such an energy in Edinburgh because the whole town is bursting with just creativity and shows. And so it's incredible. And the first time I was there, I only did stand-up spots. And so it's kind of like a boot camp because you can do like 6 show a day or something.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, it's really, really fun and really amazing. And you get to bond with your fellow comedians and you get to just get better at your craft. That's also when there's no pressure involved. As soon as people start noticing you and as soon as you do your own show, then there's a lot of pressure of meeting expectations. That can get a bit like overwhelming, I would say. And so you kind of need to go into Edinburgh just feeling good about yourself, feeling good about the show you're doing, and then also knowing that none of it really matters, even though it's presented like it is. Because if you have a good Edinburgh, it can change your career. And if you have a bad Edinburgh, hopefully nobody notices and you can come back and have a good Edinburgh. Mm. So there's a lot of pressure once you do it in a way where you're selling yourself, like once you're the name.
Yeah.
But it's really fun.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that much pressure. But yeah, it must be amazing. So all of these different types of culture and art, including comedy, descending on Edinburgh all in one go.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's, have you ever been?
I haven't been to the Fringe itself, but I was in Edinburgh last summer, sort of a couple of weeks before, and that was sort of my first taste. I think there was a jazz festival going on at the time, so you just walked into different parts of the city and there would just be stuff going on in the street. And this was even before Fringe, so I can't imagine what it's actually like during the month of. I did see that they have like these ginormous, basically like Argos catalogues, full of some of the, like a selection of the different performances that there will be like going on throughout the city during Fringe. And I was just flicking through it, being like, wow, I have to come back and actually probably experience it once it's on, maybe next year.
yeah, definitely. That's such a good way of putting it. Argos catalogs of comedians. That's definitely what it is. You have so many things to pick from. It's insane.
I went to a great comedy set by the comedian London Hughes, who's also a woman. She's also a person of colour. And she played at Soho Theatre at the end of last year. Something which she made several jokes about in her amazing, really funny set was about how comedians who are sort of average looking but male get loads of people hitting on them, but then comedians like herself who are really attractive, funny, and a comedian do not.
Yeah, that's really true. That's really true. I mean, if we just take me and Nigel as example, Nigel gets like so many DM slides, insanely amounts of DM slides, and really, really like pretty people, like any male comedian, really, just really pretty girls coming up to them after shows. And then
you're exposing him now.
I am exposing him. I don't care. And then like female comedians, we just get the weird kind of like divorcee who's like been sitting and getting drunk all night, and then he comes up and he's like, haha, I really liked your joke about your vagina. Oh. And it's like, yeah, that's your opening. All right. Really disgusting.
I sometimes feel like that's just men in general sometimes, isn't it? Like, why do they not know how to just be a normal, polite, respectful human being?
I know, right?
Obviously, this is a very generic topic, generic generalization, but so many women I know have had messages similar to that, even if they aren't speaking about their vagina on stage.
Really?
And I just don't understand. How can they possibly think that that's okay?
Exactly. It's like, oh, you're looking at me as an object? Great. Let me just give you my number. It's like, no, just talk to me like a human being.
Yeah, like no romance story has ever started off with, oh, he slid into my DMs and kept messaging me, even though I clearly wasn't interested and wasn't replying. He kept messaging me and messaging me over a whole year, and that's how we fell in love.
That's
no
so
story
funny.
ever goes like that.
I just realized that he would always be there for me. And if I didn't get together with him, he would probably kill me. Oh. So funny. Do you get a lot of like yellow fever stuff happening to yourself?
Unfortunately, it does happen. It seems to just be like a conversation starter in bars and stuff. Like people don't know what to talk about. So they want to talk about, you know, how much Mandarin they know. I'm like, all right.
Oh my God.
Great. Ni hao to you too.
How much Mandarin they know.
I think that's a very typical experience for me. And I'm like, you know what? I am okay. You can just ask me like, do you come here often? What do you do for work? I mean, I'm totally okay with those questions as well. You don't need to tell me about your year abroad teaching English in Korea or Cambodia. People love telling me about countries which I have very little association with. Do you get that as well?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's like you say, they think it's a conversation starter. And you're like, I mean, you could just ask me if I've seen the latest episode of, like, The Office or something. Well, oh, man, that really shows, like, the last time I went out and dated. But you can just ask me if I've seen, like, The Irishman or something like that. Instead of, like, oh, hey, where in China are you from? I speak Mandarin. I did a year abroad there. It's like, I don't care. I've lived here. I don't know. But then I wonder if I do it, because if I hear that somebody's Italian, I'm like, oh my God, I went to blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. And it was amazing. And I love focaccia. So maybe I'm as bad. I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes I do catch myself asking things. Like I asked one of my friends who's mixed race, he's half black and half white. And I asked him, oh, do you feel more black or more white? Like I just wanted to like learn more about him. And it was only when he replied saying, oh, I don't really know exactly, but I'm just me. And I thought, oh, okay, I really shouldn't have asked that, because if he wanted to tell me about his ethnic identity, he would have. And me asking has just sort of otherized him. And I hate it when people do that to me. So, yeah, you know, we're all learning.
Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But I now have a pretty good filter for filtering out guys who might have yellow fever on dating apps.
How?
Basically, if they have more than one reference to anything relating to the continent of Asia, that's definitely a swipe left for me. So it might be something about, you know, my next travel destination is Japan, or maybe they'll have a picture of them in some sort of Asian temple, or if they have, some people even have in their profile, they say like, I'm specifically looking for Asian women, or I saw that one guy said, I'm looking for someone who's just left of vanilla on the spectrum.
Serious?
So basically what they're looking for is someone sort of light skin, a little bit exotic, but not too exotic. That I think that's what he was trying to get at.
Oh my God. And,
yeah. Once you start getting used to it, you I'm able to filter them out quite quickly, and it's working so far.
Yeah,
it's obviously not fully fair, because I'm sure some of the people who have one holiday picture in Japan are still perfectly nice, not racist guys who don't have yellow fever. But you know what? I just can't be bothered. It's not worth the risk.
The risk is too big. We've been hurt before. It's so funny. I need to start employing that filter system.
Yeah, it's honestly just not worth it. And the reason I do that is because I don't want to put myself, or I don't want to get myself into a situation where I have people saying things like, oh, I heard that Chinese girls have tight pussies. People say these things to Chinese girls, or anyone who might even look Chinese, and not girls, women. And you know what? I don't want to hear that.
Yeah, it's just that's so disgusting. Awful. Oh, then you go like, oh yeah, I've heard that guys like you have small penises. Oh, that's awful. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like men in general, I mean, towards women on dating apps are horrendous. But when you have any type of an ethnicity, like they just go vile. They get really disgusting. It's awful.
What do you think it's down to? Like, why do you think that's the case?
I think it definitely has something to do with the exotification of women who aren't of their own race. But also, when it comes to Asian women, specifically East Asian and Southeast Asian, it definitely, I think, how they were portrayed during the wars that have been, like the Vietnam War and the Korean War and stuff, and how women during that time, I'm not sure of the history exactly, but the fact that, you know, these countries were invaded and they were quite rural countries to begin with. And so in order to, I guess, survive, maybe some women had to go, you know, engage in sex work. And so I think that's definitely has something to do with it. And also nowadays, a lot of men who go over to Southeast Asian countries that are poorer.
Ooh, yeah, exactly. No, I hate
and just kind of, it's like, marry women and bring them back here. And it's also this thing of like, I don't know where the stereotype comes from, but the fact that East Asian and Southeast Asian women are submissive or demure towards men, which I think is like, I mean, it's kind of a cultural thing as well, because like Asian culture can be quite sexist, because everybody wanted a boy and the daughter is only like good for marrying off and blah blah blah, so you know, maybe we brought it on ourselves too. No. So I guess it's just that history, and then that's permeated common knowledge, and that's why maybe people think that East Asian women can be treated a certain way.
Yeah, it definitely.
Which is really awful.
Definitely still exists and affects our sort of present day society. And I think we would be really ignorant to assume that society can change that quickly.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, the wars were not that long ago. We might not hear about it much now, but that's more down to like the awful history education that we get in the West about, for example, the British Empire and colonization. It's like we pretty much hear nothing. And I think there's often a misconception that, oh, it's sort of consensual, so it's okay. as in people choose to go into sex work or people choose to marry a rich foreign white man. And ultimately, it's not really consensual if there's such a dodgy power play in terms of, yeah, power and wealth, like the dynamics there are really skewed. So it's all a bit gross because they might feel like they have no choice but to marry a foreign man and be his, I think, sex slave. Other people would say wife, because he's paying for the family or whatever,
yeah.
Or, you know, giving her a better life. You do see that a lot, which obviously is not the case for every white man who's ever married an Asian woman, but it still happens across lots of countries. Present day.
Yeah.
Ooh, it gives me the heebie-jeebies just thinking about it.
It's really awful. And actually, I saw a documentary quite recently that it's starting to happen in Asian countries as well. Like people from, like it was a documentary about how Korean men are now going to like Vietnam or Cambodia and marrying women and bringing them back to Korea, South Korean men. And I was like, wow, that's so fascinating because you know, South Korea is really prosperous and, you know, great country. But then it's like, oh, so that's happening in Asia now. So you can see how big the, like, discrepancy still is in those countries.
Yeah. I think that's like a big part of history that we don't talk about as well, and also relates to why I don't want to treat the Asian experience as homogenous, because there is a lot of animosity between different Asian countries. Like, Japan was a big colonizer and there's still some bad feelings there.
There's
still a lot of, like, poor relations between sort of China and lots of Asian countries. And yeah, we can't just say like, oh, you know, you guys all look the same, so you probably are all the same person. But there's so many different experiences. I think a big part of, like, exoticization, if that's a word, of Asian women is still in the forefront because of porn.
Yeah.
So, like, Asian being its own whole category of, then they have all the subcategories within that as well. And it's just really, really gross because in sort of a lot of different types of porn, a lot of different genres of porn, the women are very submissive, but that's particularly the case with like the Asian category.
Exactly. Yeah. It's definitely like it's a fetish rather than I feel like whenever it comes to like Asian women or even Black women in porn or even Black men, it's more like a fetish category than it is like, I don't know. Well, I guess maybe anything in porn or has to do with sex becomes a fetish. Or, you know, like, as opposed to, like, just a regular category or, like, a preference. It always becomes, like, a exotified, you know, it perpetuates objectification of Asian women and other people. Yeah.
Yeah, it's almost like Caucasian is always, like, the default. And then anything else is something like, I don't know, what do I feel like today? I feel like some Chinese. It's always like something different.
That's hilarious, yeah. It's strange. Yeah, definitely. What was it? I was talking to somebody about it. They were like, yeah, in the West, it's like that. But then there's so much like porn, like Asian porn, like Japanese porn or Korean porn and stuff. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. But then it's like Japanese porn is weird.
Yeah, it's weird
it's
as well.
It's really weird, man.
They have lots of different subcategories that I don't even know whether anyone even enjoys it in a sexual way or whether they just think it's funny in a sort of a meme way.
In a meme way. Maybe.
Actually, you know what? I guess there's someone out there who likes all these different things. There's a porn category for everyone.
Yeah, definitely. So. There's a porn category for everyone. Yeah.
That's a weird soundbite. I really appreciate you being like quite open with your experiences and being a comedian. I do appreciate that. I have one last question, which is just a bit of a silly one. It's a very heteronormative fuck, marry, kill question.
Okay.
So out of the following three, which one would you fuck, which one would you marry, and which one would you kill?
Okay.
Firstly, Swedish men. Secondly, Chinese men. And thirdly, British men.
Oh my God.
Fuck, marry, kill.
I would say Swedish men could fit into all three categories because they're really great husbands. I would say that when it comes to like equality and stuff between the sexes, they're very good. And also they're very handsome. But then also they're the white devil and must be destroyed. So they could fit into all three. But I think choosing, I would say, okay, so is it a Chinese man? Do I get to pick like a Chinese diaspora man or like a Chinese man from China or like?
I guess this is a very difficult question because I did say like Chinese men in general, and I don't think we should be killing off all men of any ethnicity.
No, that's true. Except for Brit. I mean, I've decided I'm going to kill off British.
Oh, okay.
I'm just deciding. Yeah. I'm just deciding who to marry, Chinese man or a Swedish man.
Okay, well, since you stated all those strong qualities about Swedish men, I'll let you have your pick of what type, what category of Chinese man you would like.
Okay. Huh. I guess an Asian American diaspora Chinese man would be cool. In that case, because I know for a fact that just Swedish guys are great as husbands, then do I want to keep it in my culture? this is tough.
I guess there's a bigger question here about interracial marriages and dating.
Yeah, that's true. You know what? I'm going to go with Asian American Chinese diaspora guy to marry, and then I'll bang a Swedish guy.
Fab.
That's a good deal.
Hitler's wet dream.
Hitler's wet dream. Definitely.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. I'm curious to know why you are so sure that you would kill British men out of those three.
Oh my God, they're... Look at them.
Is that a stupid question for me to be asking?
British men? No, this is like definitely generalizing all British men. But I would say that a lot of them have issues with expressing emotion. And I can't deal with it. And also banter. I don't get banter. I'm so bad at banter.
Well, that sort of laddie, blokey banter.
Exactly. It's like, okay, you do banter instead of saying what you actually feel and think. I can't spend my whole life doing that.
Do you think that's not the case for Swedish men in terms of expressing emotions authentically and not just through rubbish jokes?
No, so there are rubbish jokes, definitely, but Swedish people are pretty good at being genuine as well. Like, they don't like confrontation, but they can be very direct and very honest, which I appreciate, but they only do it if they feel like it's necessary. But like British people don't do it at all. There's never like a confrontation. I've never had one with my housemates. They just don't talk to you for a little bit. And then you wonder if you've done something wrong, which you have, according to them. And then it's like back to banter. And I'm like, oh, but I can't. Just tell me what I've done wrong so I can not do it anymore. Just let me know how you feel.
It shouldn't be that difficult, but it is. Evelyn, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on my podcast. And we've had a really fun conversation, but also touching on some quite serious topics. And I really appreciate you being frank and honest and sharing some of your experiences as a Chinese-Swedish comedian, also working and living in the UK.
Thank you so much for having me, Natalie. It was great. It was really fun to talk about these things. I hope I didn't go too serious and bum everybody out.
No. Of course. I think it's great. Definitely worth talking about. Is there anything that you would like to plug, or where can people find you online?
So on social media, I'm at Evelyn Mock on both Instagram and Twitter. And then I have a TikTok that I update very precariously at Evelyn Mock for you. And then, of course, check out our podcast, Rice to Meet You podcast.
Yeah, so that's Evelyn Mock. The surname is M-O-K, but I'll put the links in the show notes below. Do you also want to plug your Patreon?
Yes! That's good, actually. Thank you for reminding me. Nigel would be upset if I didn't. We also have a Patreon. As you guys know, it's really trying times now. So as comedians, we've lost all our work, basically, because we perform for live audiences. So we've just focused all of our attention into the podcast. So we keep making new stuff for you. We have 2 episodes a week now, and we're making little videos on the side. So if you guys want to support us, you can head to patreon.com/ricetomeetyoupod, and you'll find all the information there.
Thank you so much, Evelyn. And if you're listening to this podcast, you will probably love their podcast. Actually, if you hate this podcast, I don't know why you're listening, but you will definitely love Rice to Meet You Pod instead. So go check it out.
That's very nice of you to say. I think people love this podcast too, so.
Thank you.
Aww. Thank you so much, Natalie. Bye.
if you enjoyed this episode, definitely go check out Evelyn on social media. She's actually been posting more TikToks recently, so it's worth checking her out there. So catch me next week when I'll be a year older. If you want to give me a birthday present, please screenshot that you're listening to this episode and share it on your story. Tag me on Instagram at yellowbeepod so I can reshare it. That's how I'm accepting birthday wishes this year. Thanks. At yellowbeepod on Twitter or Instagram. And it's been your girl, Natalie. Bye.